People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and we hope you'll stay tuned for a very special edition of PTR as Chris Mahon takes us on a tour of Haymarket Square in Chicago, Illinois. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. The international celebration of labor solidarity, known as May Day, was born in Chicago, Illinois, at Haymarket Square. Lecturer, writer, and historian Chris Mahon takes us on a tour of this historical site.
Here we are at the corner of Randolph and Des Plaines, and there aren't any really obvious markings, if you look around, to commemorate a very, very famous place in the history not only of the United States, but of the world. On the night of Tuesday, May 4th, 1886, there was a protest meeting here. And that protest meeting was broken up by the police. And out of that, labor leaders were placed on trial. Some of them were subsequently executed. And then out of that came the May Day holiday that, while it's not that well known in the United States, is commemorated as Labor Day virtually throughout the world. In the 1880s, Chicago was the fastest growing city in the world. And so this city was a city in which factories were booming. People were coming into this city from all over the world, but yet there were terrible conditions in the factories. People had to work many, many hours, and conditions were unsafe. And as a result of that, you had two different motions that were going on. One, you had a general national motion to get an eight-hour day, and then you also had specific fights in specific industries and factories. Now, to set this scene for May 4th, it happened on May 4th. On May 1st of 1886, there was a gigantic demonstration on Michigan Avenue to demand the eight-hour day. That was part of a general series of demonstrations throughout the United States. But on May 3rd, there was an incident of police brutality at the McCormick Reaper plant, and there was a decision by a number of labor leaders to call a meeting for the next night.
Chris Mahon talks about how the Chicago fire impacted the events at Haymarket Square.
You had this terrible, terrible tragedy. You had the poorest section of the population, as always happens in these sorts of tragedies, earthquakes in California or in Nicaragua or wherever, it's the poor who suffer the most. But then when the world responds and sends its relief supplies and its donations to these charitable committees, as has happened in other instances, that money doesn't necessarily trickle down to the poorest section of the population. There was even a situation where businessmen would borrow money from the relief funds without any interest. And out of that began the first efforts for the organization of the working class, some of the first efforts for the organization of the working class in Chicago, where people started demanding that they be helped, the people who needed it the most. And some of the leaders who emerged in the Haymarket era first began their social activity, their activity on behalf of the poor and the working class population as a result of the Chicago Fire of 1871. So now we're standing at the spot here of what's known as Crane's Alley. It was right here where there was a wagon that was set up. Okay, there's, if you can imagine, there was this square just a few feet from us. We've walked just a little bit north from where we were just a moment ago. And at this spot, at this alley, there was a wagon. And on that wagon, various speakers were speaking, various leaders of the union movement in Chicago at that time. And a number of them were foreign-born workers, August Spies, other leaders of the union movement. Now, and the fight for the eight-hour day. Now, what happened was that this movement, or this rally, started at about 8:30. Originally, there was 2,500 people at the rally. The rally received a permit from the mayor. The mayor actually came to this spot and listened to some of the speeches. But what happened was that this was a rally that had been called on one day's notice, and it was actually a little bit disorganized. And So people began to drift away, as sometimes happens. Some of the speeches were a little bit long. And so by about 10:30, there was a speaker, Samuel Fielden, who was a very, very decent man. He was a working class man who had emigrated from England. His family had been involved in supporting the Union during the American Civil War, you know, part of that section of the British population that stood with the Union. But he was actually a bit of a dull speaker. He was speaking, people were starting to drift away, and at that point, 76 actually, to be absolutely precise, police officers marched up from the area that's now behind us, and they began to break up the meeting. And Samuel Fielden said to the officer who insisted that they disperse, "But officer, we are peaceable." And he began to descend from the wagon. At that point, someone in the crowd, or someone, threw a bomb. At that point, the police began firing. The bomb killed several people. The police then began firing, and they killed a number of people, including a number of police officers, and wounded a number of others. And then basically a reign of terror broke out in the city of Chicago, where the police went around and basically just did away with freedom of speech in this city. I mean, they broke into union halls, they broke into immigrant societies, they broke into socialist and anarchist organizations' offices, and arrested anyone who they thought might have some connection with the incident. And they arrested several leaders of the union movement and the revolutionary movement of that time and charged them with conspiracy. We're actually stepping into the alley right now as I speak. The bomb, it was thrown northward towards the wagon. I think one of the things that's significant is that this incredible incident, this incident which is recorded in so many history books around the world and which is marked by gigantic Labor Day demonstrations in Paris and Mexico City and cities all over the world, I'm going to show you the complete extent of its commemoration by the city of Chicago. We are coming up to it right now, so let's just walk over there now. We're walking through the alley, and we come to the sidewalk. And in the sidewalk, next to some weeds on a chain fence, is a very small plaque. And this is the grand total of the commemoration by the city of Chicago of this historic incident. And it took considerable struggle by the trade union movement, by the labor historians of this city, by decent people of the city, to even get this. And I think this shows how dangerous this history is to the powers that be in the United States. So I'd just like to read the plaque.
It's really amazing, Chris, in the fact that we just rode on the L train past the United Center, which, of course, as you were pointing out to me, was built on the site that at one time was public housing and was torn down to build this monument to professional sports, where there's a huge statue of Michael Jordan in front of the stadium. And here we are in Haymarket Square, and, you know, truth be told, I mean, this is incredible how paltry this is. I mean, I really wish people could see this, because, I mean, it is, on some level, without discounting the work that the people put in to get this, I mean, it's really on some level almost insulting to the memory of the place.
I would agree. And if, let me just read it here so that our listeners get a sense of it. It says, "Chicago landmark, site of the Haymarket tragedy, 1886. And I can actually just barely read this. This is how paltry it is. But it says, a decade of strife between labor and industry culminated here in a confrontation that resulted in the something death, I can barely read this, of tragic death of both workers and policemen on May 4th, 1886, spectators at a labor rally had gathered around the mouth of nearby Crane's Alley. A contingent of police approaching on Desplein Street were met by a bomb thrown from just south of the alley. The resultant trial of eight activists gained worldwide attention for the labor movement and initiated the tradition of May Day labor rallies in many cities. Designated on March 25, 1992, Richard M. Daley, Mayor, Commission on Chicago Landmarks.
And, of course, as we almost get run over by a garbage truck backing into the alley.
You notice it says, designated on March 25th, 1992, Richard M. Daley, Mayor. So it took until 1992. We're talking about an incident that took place in May of 1886. It took over 100 years to get this. I mean, even in 1986. Now, in 1986, Harold Washington was the mayor of the city, and there was a commemoration. I will grant you that. But to get this plaque took over 100 years.
And we're now at the other side of Haymarket Square, next to the freeway. Which freeway is this, Chris?
This is the Kennedy Expressway. We're standing next to what's now a large circle where clearly there was something that was taken away. And the story about this is that at this spot, there was, and this is a spot much, much larger than the plaque that now exists to commemorate the incident, there was actually a statue in honor of the police and the police action at Haymarket Square. What happened was that after the incident took place, the Chicago Tribune, which was a very anti-labor newspaper, began a campaign to get a statue erected to commemorate the police. So a committee of Chicago businessmen raised over $10,000, and they selected someone to design a statue of a police officer in the traditional police dress of that time, you know, the sort of 1890s style, 1880s, 1890s police style. And he was raising his hand, and it said, "I raise my hand to protect the citizens of Chicago." But there's a long, long story that goes with it. First of all, the person who was selected to design the statue, while leaving this posh club, saw a policeman on the street and decided to model the statue after this policeman. But the policeman was Irish, and so when he did the design, the design clearly looked like an Irish cop, and the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant gentry of the city who wanted this sculpture to the police was horrified that it looked Irish. So the sculptor refused to change the figure. The statue was finally dedicated on Memorial Day 1889 with about 2,000 people present. It was a rainy spring day, and 176 policemen took part in the ceremony, the same number that had marched up Desplein Street 3 years earlier. And the mayor unveiled the statue with the words, "May it stand here unblemished so long as the metropolis shall endure to say to the millions who come upon it, this is a free and lawful country with plenty of room for the people of all the earth who choose to come here to breathe the free air and to obey these laws, not an inch of room or an hour to dwell here for those who come for any other purpose." In the 1920s, a streetcar driver named O'Neill drove his streetcar full speed and jumped the track, knocking it off the base, because he said he was sick of seeing that policeman with his arm raised. In 1928, the statue was repaired and moved to Union Park. And then in 1956, the statue was moved to a special platform built for it during the construction of the Kennedy Expressway. On May 4th, 1968, the statue was defaced with black paint after an incident in the Civic Center with the police during a demonstration against the Vietnam War. On October 6, 1969, the statue was blown up, and some people allege that was by the Weathermen faction of the SDS. Mayor Daley promised to replace it. That was the original Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley. And Wally Phillips, a disc jockey, helped raise the money. The new statue was unveiled on May 4th, 1970. I think it's ironic that that's the day of the killings at Kent State. That was the day that the new statue was unveiled. But the statue was again blown up on October 6, 1970, and it was again restored. What finally happened was the mayor ordered round-the-clock security that cost the city $67,440 a year. In February 1972, the statue was removed from its base and placed in the lobby of the Central Police Headquarters at State and 11th Street. And I actually, a number of years ago, conducted a tour with a number of revolutionaries from Belgium and Morocco and Tunisia who came to the United States, and I brought them here to Haymarket Square. And they were, of course, horrified that you know, in Belgium, you commemorate May Day as a special day, Labor Day, and the fact that here in the place where May Day was born, they had the statue, even the base of the statue to the police was to them, of course, horrifying. So I think it just says something about the values of the powers that be in this city, that you have this tiny little plaque that doesn't even really commemorate the workers. It's sort of neutral, as I read earlier. And then you had a statue glorifying police violence.
Chris Mahon gives us an example of the city's attempts to change the very name of Haymarket Square.
We're actually standing in a traffic island in the middle of Randolph Street here. And right to my right is a sign that says Randolph Market. Now, this is the site of what actually used to be the Haymarket Square itself. And there was a time when even people who didn't perhaps know the history of the incident, of the tragedy here, would refer to this area as Haymarket. But what has started to happen is that the city powers that be are renaming this area. And there are a number of banners on the lampposts that say West Loop Gate. This is what the city of Chicago will do when it wants to change people's attitude towards a neighborhood. They'll give the neighborhood a new name. So not only is the incident being expunged from memory, but the very name is being discouraged.
The saga of Haymarket continues as we move farther north through the city of Chicago. We're standing on the corner of Illinois and Dearborn in front of a Chicago fire department station.
We are at the site, the former site of Cook County Jail, where the defendants in the Haymarket case were held as they awaited execution. What happened was that there was the reign of terror that took place in the city of Chicago after the Haymarket tragedy, where trade unions had their doors kicked in and there was a great hue and cry against the union movement, and 8 people were indicted for conspiracy to commit murder. And of those, 7 of them were born or raised outside the United States. And one of the things that the prosecution and the opponents of the labor movement tried to say was that the labor movement of that time was a foreign conspiracy. So you had 8 people, 6 of whom were born or raised in Germany, 1 of whom had emigrated from England, Samuel Fielden, and 1 person born inside the United States, Albert Parsons, who were the leaders of the trade union movement of that time. Albert Parsons managed to slip out of the city of Chicago and he went to Wisconsin. But when he realized that his friends were going to stand trial, he voluntarily came back from Wisconsin and walked into the trial, this conspiracy trial on the first day, and said to a stunned courtroom, "Your Honor, I have come back to stand trial with my innocent comrades." And they were placed on trial, and after a really sham trial that marked with a spirit of conspiracy in the city, they were convicted. And several of them were sentenced to die. And they awaited in this place. Albert Parsons used to refer to it as the Bastille. When Parsons wrote to his wife, Lucy, he always referred to the jail as the Cook County Bastille Cell number 29, was how he described his address. And that was here in the spot that's directly behind me.
When you're talking about the trial being a sham trial, talk a little bit more about that.
Well, first of all, you had a situation where it was conducted in a spirit of anti-foreigner prejudice, where there was all sorts of lurid press accounts. But the other thing to keep in mind is that these 8 people were placed on trial explicitly for being the leaders of a movement which had called this rally. And the theory was that there was a bomb that had been thrown. It was thrown at a rally. So the people who called the rally or some way associated, planned the rally, were therefore responsible for the bomb being thrown. So it was a complete case of indirect guilt by association. In fact, some of the people who were placed on trial were not physically present at the rally when the rally took place. Not only did they not throw the bomb at all, and it's never been established in the more than 100 years since who threw the bomb. I mean, there's a lot of speculation that it was a police agent provocateur who did that, but no one definitively knows who threw the bomb. The eight people were not accused of being the actual hurler of the bomb. They were explicitly placed on trial, and the prosecution, in its closing remarks, said that we have to hold these people responsible because they are the leaders of a movement which threatens society. So in that sense, it was a complete sham, and there was great outrage around the world to the decision, and people saw that it was a real attack on freedom of speech and freedom of organization to convict these people for something that none of them had done. I mean, none of the people had actually thrown the bomb. One of the guys, Samuel Fielden, was on the wagon. He was the person who said, "But officer, we are peaceable." He was climbing down from the wagon as the bomb was thrown. Clearly, he could not have thrown the bomb. So it was, in that sense, just a complete and utter sham and a travesty of justice.
Hey, it's interesting when you say that the prosecutor, in his final summation, said these people are the leader of a movement that threatens society.
That's right. And they were, the city fathers were absolutely clear on that point, that we're going after the leaders of the revolutionary movement to stop the revolutionary movement by cutting off its head. And I think that we see similar things to that today, with attacks on different sections of society, attacks on people who've played a role in bringing injustices to light, people like Mumia Abu-Jamal. You know, you can see the same sort of thing today. And also the whole element of the anti-foreigner dimension, you know, the accusing of the foreigner of being a terrorist. I mean, there was a great element of particularly anti-German prejudice. And you look at, and today, in some of the anti-Arab prejudice, you can see echoes of that same, whenever there's some terrorist incident, the assumption that it's Arabs who are responsible and so forth, the kind of ugly things that took place after the Oklahoma City bombing. You can see real similarities between what happened here and what happened there.
Chris Mahon brings us to the final stop on our journey through the history of Haymarket.
We are at a very solemn place. We are in a courtyard in downtown Chicago, actually an alley, and it's completely unmarked by any memorial commemoration of any kind, but this is the place where the Haymarket martyrs were executed. And this is the spot where four people were hanged on the morning of November 11th, 1887, in one of the greatest travesties of justice in the history of the United States. And what happened was that in the Haymarket case, that these eight people went on trial, and they had, as I said, this sham trial, and they were convicted. And then there was a desperate, desperate effort around the world to get the courts of the United States to rescind the decision, or to get the government to commute the sentences. And this involved people all over the world, in England, in Europe. John Brown's son became involved, and in particular, the wife of Albert Parsons, Lucy Gonzalez Parsons, spoke all over the United States for months, taking her children with her and working herself almost to exhaustion, but it was to no avail. And so finally, on the morning of November 11th, 1887, authorities came to the cells of the four men, and they marched them out to this courtyard, and they were hanged. And Albert Parsons, I think it's worth noting that Lucy Gonzalez Parsons attempted to get into the prison, and she was physically restrained and imprisoned herself. And Albert Parsons, as he was being hanged, I mean, as they were literally putting the noose around his neck, you know, was giving a speech in defense of his actions and in defense of the cause of the working class, and said, you know, "Let the voice of the people be heard." And it literally took the tightening of the noose and the dropping of the platform and his hanging to stop him from agitating. I mean, this was a man who literally agitated for the cause of the working class at this spot until he was hanged to his death. And it is, to me, just obscene that there is nothing here. We're standing here in a parking lot with a bunch of cars, and there's nothing to commemorate this place now. The ruling class of the United States of North America is desperately afraid of teaching even the facts of labor history to the people of the United States and to the working class of the United States, because I think that they understand that this working class, once it gets in motion, will go all the way. That in the United States, the thing about the United States is that it's very difficult to get people involved into political activity, but particularly the poorest section of the population, for a lot of historical reasons. But the history of the different struggles in the United States is that once a struggle begins, it becomes very, very intense, often very violent, and has world-shattering significance. I mean, the United States Civil War, the struggle for the eight-hour day represented by what happened here, these things shook the whole world. So I think that the ruling class understands that what it's got to do is it's got to prevent a struggle from even getting started. It's got to prevent people from getting even the most basic rudiments of knowledge. So since that's the ruling class's strategy, I think that the revolutionary strategy has to be just the opposite, and that is, at all cost, let's get the struggle started. Let's get people into political motion. Let's get people fighting for something along the right strategic lines, around the right conceptions. And no matter how impure it is at first, no matter how much people have to learn in the course of the struggle, and let's teach people, since the ruling class is so deathly afraid of history, as shown in the fact that they can't have the decency to put anything in this place just to mark what happened here, then let's teach the working class of the United States, let's teach the poor of the United States its revolutionary history, let's build a revolutionary press, let's develop a core of public speakers, let's build an organization of revolutionaries. And that's why I'm a member of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, is precisely to do that, to create an army of agitators and propagandists who will do what Albert Parsons did at this spot, which was literally to agitate right up until the moment he died. And so I would say to everyone listening to this message, I would appeal to them, to, in the spirit of Albert Parsons, to join the League of Revolutionaries for a New America.
Chris Mann, thank you.
Thank you.
From the streets of Chicago, I'm Mike Thornton. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. Thanks to the overwhelming response to PTR in our first year, the program is now available twice monthly and on the internet at www.ptradio.org. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same technologies of robotics and computerization that are being used to displace millions of workers worldwide is used for the benefit of the planet as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League, our Speakers Bureau, or our other print and audio publications, you can contact us at 1-800-691-6888. That number once again, 1-800-691-6888. My name's Mike Thornton. On behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.